About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves.
And I'm Don Bishop. We're your hosts for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jim McLennan, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing Alberta's famous Bow River. This broadcast will be 90 minutes in length. We're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Jim your most important question. We'll receive your questions promptly, and we're going to try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight.
This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 12 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of the broadcast is copyrighted in the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this show cannot be distributed or sold in any form.
When we return, we'll be talking with Jim McLennan about fly fishing Alberta's famous Bow River.
New from the Winston Rod Company for 2007, Boron 2T rods, new technology, traditional feel. This series combines the feel of our traditional action rods with the lightness and responsiveness of our latest technology. These rods offer the ultimate and delicate presentation while still retaining a good measure of power and reserve, thanks to the dynamic properties of our Boron 2 technology. These four-piece rods are available in 3 through 5 weight and retail for $625. They are designed and crafted in the Winston shop. And for our drawing tonight, we're giving away a copy of Jim McLennan's book, Blue Ribbon Bow, published by Johnson Gorman Publishers, and a copy of another book that he's written, which is Fly Fishing Western Trout Streams, published by Stackpole Books, and also a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, which are Twin Bridges, Montana, and feature the traditional Winston green finish and Winston unconditional lifetime warranty. Cast the new Boron 2T at the best place possible, your local specialty fly shop. Before we introduce Jim, we'd like to let you know about our great gifts we have to give away. Originates out of the same area that Jim does up there in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. So you have three chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet, you can go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Jim's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show.
Our guest tonight is Jim McLennan. Jim is a native of Alberta, Canada, and he was one of the first guides on Alberta's famed Bow River, beginning back in 1976. He also was co-owner of Calgary's first fly fishing store until he served as a regional business manager for the Orvis Company from 2000 to 2004. Jim and his wife, Linda, now live in Okotoks, Alberta, where they host fly fishing trips and fly fishing schools and clinics. And Jim works at his writing and photography and various speaking engagements. Their website, www.mclennanflyfishing.com, has detailed information. And tonight I'm hopeful that Jim will let us in on a little bit more about his bird dogs and also his second lifelong passion, which is music. Jim's well known in the fly fishing world, and he's a frequent speaker at fly fishing events throughout North America. He hosted two seasons of the television series Iron Blue Fly Fishing on Outdoor Life Network, and he has been named an editor-at-large for Fly Fisherman magazine, where his writing and photography appear regularly. His work also appears in other outdoor magazines, including the Canadian Fly Fisher, Gray's Sporting Journal, and Fly Fusion magazine. Jim McLennan has written three fly fishing books. You've heard about those. Including his award-winning Blue Ribbon Bow, which has since been revised and updated. And he has also authored Trout Streams of Alberta, another award winner, and most recently, the Fly Fishing Western Trout Streams, which covers waters from Mexico to Canada. Jim's here tonight to answer your most important questions about fly fishing the legendary Bow River, and has also promised to give us a little insight into some of the other fly fishing opportunities to be had in southern Alberta. Jim, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thanks very much. I've been looking forward to it, and I'm happy to be here and to get after it.
Yeah.
Well, that we will, Jim, that we will. We've got a lot of great questions tonight.
Yeah, we do.
Good.
Our guest tonight is Jim McLennan. Jim is a native of Alberta, Canada, and he was one of the first guides on Alberta's famed Bow River, beginning back in 1976. He also was co-owner of Calgary's first fly fishing store until he served as a regional business manager for the...
As always, probably too much to cover in an hour and a half, but we'll do our best. What we're going to try to do is talk about the Bow River itself and what it all entails, how it flows, what kind of access you can get to it, how to fish it. And we'll also try to dig in with, what kind of equipment he uses, specific flies, hatches on that river, how to fish that river, strategies and presentations on the Bow, and also talk about some other areas that are close by that you might want to fish. And we'll kind of finish up the end of the night talking about some trip planning. If you're thinking about going to that area of Alberta, Canada, we'll give you some tips and some helpful hints on how to do that most effectively. So, Jim, let's start out talking about, where the Bow River is in the world. And maybe you could, we do have one of our first questions is from Steve Schiff in Colorado Springs, and he's planning a trip there in mid-September, wants to know how the lower Bow compares to the upper Bow near Banff. So maybe you could kind of give us a tour down river from the headwaters on down and tell us about the different parts that you might fish and how they might fish.
Sure. If the first question is where's the Bow River, the answer is in Alberta, and then for some people the next question would be where's Alberta. maybe we'll start there. Alberta is the Canadian province immediately north of Montana. It's bounded on the west by British Columbia, and to the east is Saskatchewan. The western boundary of Alberta is the Continental Divide and the Rocky Mountains, and most of our trout streams, in fact, virtually all of our trout streams, come from the mountains and flow generally eastward, including the Bow. The Bow starts in Banff National Park and flows right through the real alpine ecosystem in Banff Park, through the town of Banff, and then heads out into the foothills through the city of Calgary. Calgary is a major Canadian city, population about 1 million people. The river flows right through the middle of Calgary and then meanders its way out onto the prairie.
Jim, to...
Meets the Old Man River, becomes the South Saskatchewan, and ultimately the water drains into Hudson Bay. People are sometimes surprised that this isn't part of the Missouri River watershed, but it's not. It's a Hudson Bay watershed.
Mm-hmm.
The fishery, as is the case with most of our trout streams, in the extreme headwater reaches, is not terribly productive. We're talking about the Rocky Mountains here. The headwaters of these streams are made by melting snow and ice. There's not a lot of nutrients in the water, not a lot of algae in the rocks. And so the streams are not terribly productive right near their headwaters. And that's true of the Bow. It improves gradually and gets to be, I would say, a notable trout stream around the town of Banff, which is right in Banff Park. The river there is still in the edge of the mountains. And it's a good fishery, primarily for brown trout. And then the river moves from Banff to Calgary. The river is interrupted by a series of power dams that kind of reduce the quality of the fishery in that region. But when the river gets to Calgary, things change again. There's a regulating dam just west of Calgary that restabilizes the flow of the river. And it's the river actually from the city of Calgary downstream about 50 miles or so that is the part of the river that is best known. And the fishery in there is a combination of rainbow trout and brown trout. The big deal about the Bow is the size of the fish. The fish that reasonably experienced fly fishers will catch in the Bow downstream of Calgary is they'll probably average 18 inches, and you have a very possibility of catching a 2-foot fish. It doesn't happen every day for every fly fisherman, but it certainly happens often enough that you have a very good chance at it. So there's quite a difference actually between the upper river, say in the Banff region, and Calgary. There are more fish and bigger fish in the lower part of the river near Calgary, but that's not to say that the upper river doesn't you know, doesn't have its fans, and with good reason, because it's, the scenery is spectacular. It's one of the, you know, prettiest floats in North America, probably, is the Upper Bow.
How many dams are there on the Bow?
I think there are, I have to count on my fingers here, but I think there are three between Banff and Calgary. And then the Bear's Paw Dam, which is just west of Calgary, which, as I said, was built specifically to restabilize the river from there downstream. And that's one of the things that's created this remarkable fishery in that area. I was going to say it's not probably a true tailwater because I guess that would depend on how you define tailwater, but it's not a, a bottom draw dam off a deep reservoir cooling the water, you know, that sort of thing. It's a re-regulating dam, so I don't think you can call it a complete or a true tailwater fishery down in Calgary. But.
Okay. We've had a number of questions, and Cameron from Pueblo, Colorado, wonders about how much wading access is available and basically how much wade fishing versus boat fishing is possible on the river.
It's suited nicely to both. It is a big river in the Calgary area. It's probably 100 to 150 yards wide. If people have fished the Bighorn in Montana, it looks quite a lot like that, slightly bigger, maybe a third bigger than the Bighorn. And certainly, so it's big enough, you know, to put drift boats in and rafts, and that's a great way to fish it. More because of the unlimited access it gives you. You know, you can cross the river anytime. You can get to an island if you see one that you like. But the river fishes very well on foot. There is less foot access to the river than we'd like. There is some, and there's we have a number of good access sites. They're just not as many as we wish there were. So it's certainly possible to fish it on foot. The advantages that you get with a boat are the same ones you get on any river where you know, when you drift a river in a boat, the sort of unlimited access. It is actually, because the purpose of the dam was actually to return the flow regime to a more natural state, the dam does control the flow of the river, but it's very much like a normal freestone river, that being that we do have a spring runoff, and the water, you know, it peaks in probably the second week of June runoff, and then it recedes gradually, and you know, we get low water in the fall. So we do have a seasonal cycle of water level. So the river does is controlled by the dam. The fluctuations are generally fairly small. It's not not a huge increase and a huge decrease twice daily like you often get below power dams.
Okay. Do the flows from the dams out there, did they affect the flow of the water down below Calgary? Jim, so it's fairly consistent. You don't have to, like on some of the tailwater rivers, you can literally get stranded on the other side because the water comes up so much during
right.
the day.
No, don't. Now, that would happen if you were fishing right below one of the power dams between Banff and Calgary. But down here where we, you know, in the best section of the river to fish, no, that's not the case.
The tailwaters right below the dams are not the better section to fish, then, is what you're saying?
That's correct, yeah.
Interesting.
Because they're not the constant flow releases. So, yeah, that's...
Excuse me, Roger asked that because he's got the San Juan figured out, and he thinks that tailwaters are a piece of cake.
Okay, well, that's good.
I like the big fish there.
Oh yeah.
But you know what? When you think about that, and you made some comparisons to the Bighorn, which is an eastern flowing, kind of eastern, northeastern flowing river off the Rockies in Montana, probably much very similar in many respects. But that river, you know, the further you get away from the dam, the fishing goes downhill rather rapidly.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got about a 12-mile stretch there, and that's it.
Right.
And what you're telling us here, and by the way, folks, we do, if you go to Jim's speakers page on our site, and you can get there by going to the homepage, and where it's got the little piece about Jim there, and it says more about Jim, click on that. At the bottom of that page, we put a link to a document that has a map in it, so we can kind of reference that, Jim, tonight as we
go. Oh, good.
Through.
Yeah, that'll
but,
help.
But according to that, there's and I think you said earlier, about 50 miles of river there, or 50 kilometers, is it?
No, it's about 50 miles, and in fact, the good trout water doesn't stop at that 50-mile mark. What does stop is easy access to the river. About 50 miles downstream, it enters the Blackfoot Indian Reserve, and there's just no access in there. There's people fish down there mostly with jet boats, because you just, once you get down, there's no place to take your boat out, so you got to come back. So there are some people doing that. But the trout water, I don't know what the total length of good trout water from Calgary would be. It would be at least 75 miles, and maybe probably more than that. I mean, you know, it's a gradual change. It doesn't suddenly stop being trout water, but I know it goes down quite a ways. So access is what disappears, not the trout. Well, I think it's having, I guess let me back up. There are certainly more people fishing the river than there used to be. And, you know, people often ask, is it crowded? Is the boat crowded? And that sounds like a simple question, but it's not, because you've got to ask, compared to what? Is the boat crowded compared to how many people were fishing it 20 or 25 years ago? I guess the answer would be yes. There's a lot more people live in Calgary, and a lot more people know about the river, and a lot of people are taking up fly fishing. So there's definitely a lot more people on the river than there was 25 years ago. That would be one way to answer it. The other way would be to say, well, is the boat crowded compared to, well, for instance, the bighorn? And the answer to that is no. We've got, you know, more water, as we've already noted, and certainly you're going to see people fishing the bow during the prime season through the summer. You're going to see some other boats, but if you see, if you're floating the river and you see, I don't know, 6 to 12 other boats on the water, we think that's kind of crowded. And we get that, and we think it's kind of crowded. But I recall fishing the bighorn almost exactly a year ago in a blizzard, and we did the short float from the dam down, and I think there were about 30 boats on 3 miles in April in a blizzard on the bighorn. So, I mean, we have some people fishing, and we have more than we used to, but it is not what, you know, someone comes from the bighorn or the San Juan or the Madison or the Green, they are going to wonder where all the people are. Now, as far as what that's done to the fishing, I think that the increase in fishing pressure does the same thing as it does everywhere. That is, it makes the fish a little harder to fool. We have very good protective regulations on the river, so it doesn't impact the fishery biologically. The big fish, we've had a regulation protecting the big fish since probably sometime in the mid to late 80s. So harvest is not an issue, at least not with fly fishers. But the fish just get a little more wary, and you probably gotta have to be a little more skilled fly fisher now than you did 20 years ago. I can live with that. That's the way it goes. And I'd rather have a fishery that has a good, healthy population of fish that are hard to catch than a fishery that's been damaged in some other way, you know?
Sure. Well, let me bring up a question that comes from our international audience. Jay up in the Netherlands is wondering about the impact of crowds and pressure on the fishing on the bow, and whether that's caused any declining of the quality of the fishing.
When we're looking at this map, Jim, here, and we've got, like you said, about 50 miles between Calgary and Carsland, what are the length of the floats that you would do from a drift boat, and where would you put in and take out? What would be the optimal drifts that you would suggest?
Well, you can actually start some of the drifts in the city, and people think this is very odd, but there's good fishing right in the city, and there are a couple of put-in points right within the city of Calgary, right near one of the big freeways running through the city. There's a put-in. To my way of thinking, the real prime water starts where Highway 22X crosses the river. There's a put-in point there within Fish Creek Park. And then, I've got to give you a little background, downstream about 5 miles, there's a takeout point called Policeman's Flats. Now, in 2005, we had an enormous flood in southern Alberta, and that boat ramp and parking lot is gone, and is scheduled to be replaced this summer. So right at this moment, that access site is not there. But at some point, hopefully later this summer, it will be sort of rebuilt. The next one is
now, how many miles is that from Calgary?
That's 5 miles down from that Highway 22X access.
The 22X, okay.
Yeah. And then the next one is down about, I have to think about this a little bit, about 15 miles below that is McKinnon Flats. That's the next access site.
And so that sounds like a full day.
That's definitely, yeah. So for right now,
you got 20 miles there.
Yeah, it's too long, and it'll be a lot better when we get Policeman's rebuilt. Between McKinnon's and Carsland, there is a nice access site about two-thirds of the way down. It's called Legacy Island. It's actually an access site that is operated by our Trout Unlimited chapter here, and then at Carsland. So there's a more reasonable day float from McKinnon Flats to Legacy Island, and then a nice, reasonably short but very good float from Legacy Island to Carsland.
Okay, but it's about two-thirds, so it's about from McKinnon to Legacy Island, about 10, 12 miles?
It's maybe slightly more than that, but in that range.
Okay, so that's a reasonable float.
Yeah, the sticky part right now is that with that one access site gone, that makes it a little not as perfect as it would be when that comes back.
Well, let's take just a brief break here. When we return, we'll be talking more with Jim McClan about fly fishing on Alberta's Bow River, and he'll be telling us more about specifics about the river itself.
Mountain River Lanyard products are designed by Montana fishing guides to be rugged and functional. Check out our newest product, the Double Haul. Here, the ordinary just got wild. This lightweight product was designed with the bone fishermen, steelheader, and small stream fishermen in mind. Anglers who carry a minimal amount of gear that needs to be handy at all times. The Double Haul is sturdily built and offers a padded neck and safety release, flip-down workbench, and a ripple foam fly patch, and it gives you two spool pockets, a large accessory loop, and a secure pocket for pliers and hemostats. Most of these products can be found at your local fly shop, but for more information, you can call us at 307-734-3998. That's 307-734-3998, or visit our website at www.mountainriverlanyards, that's LANYARDS.com, mountainriverlanyards.com.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jim McClennan about fly fishing the Bow River. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Jim your most important question. We'll receive your questions promptly, and we're trying to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Jim, before we move on, why don't you briefly tell us a little bit about some of the different projects you've got going on. And while we've got you cornered on this, I'm a big fan of bird dogs and music, and if you can give me just a little teaser there, I'd love it.
Okay. Well, I'm a big fan of bird dogs and music, too. I love to hunt upland birds, and I love to do it with pointing dogs. Our current inventory here is two Britneys and an English setter. We've had Britneys and pointers before. And that's just, it's a big part of our life and something I really, really like to do. It goes nicely with fishing. It does get in the way of some of the best fishing. Getting in the way is not the right word, but one thing I like to do in the fall occasionally is steelhead fish, but the problem is it's right at the same time as the bird hunting's happening, so that's a bit of a conundrum in autumn for me. Music-wise, I've played guitar for, about 40 years, I guess, and back when I was younger, I tried to make a living by playing music in the winter and guiding fly fishermen in the summer, and, it would be hard to find two less lucrative pursuits in life than those, I guess. That's what I was trying to do.
Ski bum? You could have been a ski bum.
I suppose, yeah. That would have been, yeah. I didn't think of that, I guess. I'm still playing a little bit of music. I've got a duo with another friend of mine, and we play music as much as we can through the
not so much in the summer because we're tied up with other things. And I guess the things that keep me occupied in the fly fishing world, I do a lot of writing, as you mentioned in the intro, for magazines like Fly Fisherman and Fly Fusion and Canadian Fly Fisher. And I also like to do as much speaking as I can for clubs. I got a bunch of programs that I have available, and we've got a section about that on the website. Returned just a few days ago. I was in Toronto. The long-standing club, the Isaac Walton Fly Fishing Club, has an annual Canadian Fly Fishing Forum, and I was a speaker at that. So I really like to do as much of that as I can. And the other thing would be teaching fly fishing. Linda and I, now that we're kind of trying to freelance our way through life, do as much teaching as we can. We have a number of different fly fishing schools, from sort of half-day clinics to one-day schools to we have a nice two-day weekend school at a fishing lodge down in the Old Man River in Alberta. And we also host some trips. We have we're hosting a trip this summer to Fortress Lake, which is a beautiful lake in the Rockies of British Columbia, where you can catch brook trout between 3 and 6 pounds. So, so we're trying to do as much of this stuff as we can. I guess the big thing in the summer is the schools, and the big thing in the winter is the writing and the speaking.
I should point out to the audience that Jim was integral in the bringing of Trout Unlimited to Alberta back in the 1970s, and in 2005 he received a Conservation Memorial Award from Trout Unlimited. You mentioned the big flood of 2005, Jim, and I have a question. In fact, you may know Ellen Thomas. She's from Okotoks.
Oh, I sure do.
She wonders about the impact of that flood on the numbers of trout per mile, and if there have been any shocking or tagging studies to follow up that event.
Yeah, I looked into that as best I could. The last electrofishing results I was able to get were from that same year, from 2005, after the flood. And they showed a slight decline in the population of rainbows and browns in their test section, but still within the historical parameters. That means, you know, they've got a range that they've come to expect through the years, and the 2005 numbers were within that range. The flood event was really interesting because it was a big flood. They, you know, the press sometimes gets overexcited about this, but it was frequently called the 1 in 200 year flood. And the little town I live in here had water running down the main streets. And just to give you an example of the magnitude of the flood, another river in Alberta, the Red Deer River, which is north of here about an hour and a half, during the time of the flood, would normally have been flowing about 1,500 cubic feet per second, and it peaked at 56,000 cubic feet per second.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's kind of the sort of numbers we're talking about. I don't have the numbers on the tip of my tongue for the bow, but certainly as I mentioned, it took out the policeman's access site, and, you know, it ripped, knocked out trees and ripped up the banks and moved everything around in the river. And, you know, aside from worrying about what was happening to the basement of your house, fly fishers were wondering what this was doing to the bow and our other trout streams. And shortly after this, I was speaking to the fly fishing entomologist, Rick Hafley, who I'm sure listeners will be familiar with. He's done a lot of work in books and a lot of work with Dave Hughes over the years. And I asked him about what this would do to the bug life in the river, and he basically said, don't worry about it. Just because we haven't seen this doesn't mean it hasn't happened over the big course of history. And many of the insects, particularly mayflies and stoneflies, burrow down into the gravel, and they do this flood or no flood. A lot of the insects maybe down 2 or 3 feet below the below the surface of the gravel anyway. And that was sort of comforting. Those were comforting words, and it certainly appears to be basically true. Last year, 2006, in the Bow and in most of southwestern Alberta, was a very good year. We had, I suppose, perhaps some of the streams have smaller numbers of fish. The biologists thought they would lose some recruitment. Some of the tiny fish from, you know, that were spawned that spring may not have made it. But for what we saw in our fishing, the numbers of the fish were good, and the size of fish was really, really good everywhere. And I mentioned this to another knowledgeable guy. This is Brian Chan, who is sort of our lake fishing guru in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, we had that flood in 2005, and then last year, everywhere we went, we were catching bigger fish than normal. And he just kind of smiled and said, "That's just like rototilling your garden. Everything grows better the next year." In short, the fishing post-flood has been very good. And I think Rick Hafley was right. These things happen, and there's probably long-term more good done by this sort of event than
yeah, I would agree, because that's the problem that they have down in the Grand Canyon.
Mm.
Just as, to keep that environment healthy, is that the water has been so regulated that it actually, works against the ecosystem down there. So.
Yeah, it's not natural. Except for spring creeks, it's not natural not to have high water and floods, And it's, I guess, a good comparison would be with either the prairie or the forest, both of which need to burn every now and again.
Right, exactly.
We don't like talking about that, but that's
right.
The truth.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we've got another local there that has a question. Abe House, born in Calgary, raised in Ontario, now back in Calgary. He must like Calgary.
Yeah.
He wants you to get what?
Either he likes it or he's in the oil business, or both.
Well, he wants you to get specific. If you had three places to pick on the boat to fish by foot wading rather than drifting, where would they be and where would you get to them?
Well, there's, given the the fact that the access sites are kind of limited, I fish first of all, the policeman's access site is still available to fishing on foot. Even though it's gone, the boat ramp is gone, the parking lot is gone, there's still a place where you can park and fish on foot. And I do quite a lot of my fishing there. I like to float the river, but if I've only got a couple of hours, I just go fish on foot. And that's the closest place to where I live, so I do that. There's also good fishing both directions from McKinnon Flats and Legacy Island. The key to fishing on foot is to not to sort of park your car and plunk yourself, on the river right there and just fish for hours. It's a big river, and one of the things about people need to know about, being consistently effective on it is to sort of know how to read it, and that means knowing what water to fish and what water not to fish. So what I'm getting at here is that you need to be prepared to walk a little bit, and certainly within, 15 or 20-minute walk of any of these access sites, there's good water. And so if you just, depending on the time of day, if it's bright and sunny, I would look for broken water and fish some nymphs or streamers. And if I'm going out in the evening, I would probably intentionally look at the flats for rising fish. But, you might have to walk half a mile to get something good. But if you're willing to do that, you certainly can.
When you say walk a mile, what are the regulations there? For instance, in Montana, you can only go up to the high water line. In Colorado, if it's private, you can't even do that. What are the regulations there for that?
Ours are pretty similar to Montana. If you can get to the river without trespassing, and you then stay below the normal high water mark, you're
okay.
You're legal. You're okay. And for most of the summer, people have to understand what the high water mark is. That's the place where aquatic vegetation meets terrestrial vegetation, if you like. During runoff, the river will be above the high water mark. And for most of the summer, the edge of the water, will be, quite a ways below the high water mark. So once you get to the river, there's really very little difficulty with moving up and down it, on the edge of the river.
We have a question that just came in on the internet. Jeff Phelan of the Catskills of New York says, "Is there any place to camp at Policeman and McKinnon? P.S. I have an English setter and a German short hair."
We won't hold the short hair against
you. Yeah, you say, well, that's one out of two is not bad. But no, don't say that. There is no camping at Policeman's or at McKinnon Flats, but there's camping near both of them. There's a good campground near Policeman's, right off the main Highway 2 south of Calgary. I think it's called Pine Creek Campground. That's a good one. And then there is a good provincial campground at Carsland, right where Highway 24 crosses the river on the south side of the river there. So can't camp right at those places, but you can camp nearby. Carsland would be, I think, the only place you could camp right on the water, right on the river, and have, you know, fishing available right outside the trailer or tent.
Jim, you mentioned the regulations were promoting good-sized fish. Could you give us a brief rundown on the regs, and can you fish the bow year-round, and what license is required?
Yeah, as I said earlier, the river has been regulated with some good and quite restrictive regulations for quite a long time. Let me just give you a little bit of history maybe on that, and this is kind of, I think it's interesting, and I'm pretty sure it's significant that in the last 20 years or so, a lot of North America has come to the conclusion that the way to manage wild trout in rivers is to leave them alone and not stock the rivers. I know Montana came to this conclusion, I think, in the 1970s, and it's always seemed significant to me that Alberta reached this conclusion in the mid-50s, that dumping more hatchery fish into a stream capable of sustaining a population would do more harm than good. And that's, I think, simply, that's not questioned any longer. That's the case. So the fish in the Bow and in the rest of Alberta's streams are wild. There is no stocking of fish in moving water, and that's a great policy. So the Bow has been regulated with not completely no-kill regulations, but certainly no-kill on the larger fish. The current regulation in the river it has a limit of one trout under 35 centimeters long. Now, 35 centimeters, I don't have a ruler, but I think that's probably about 15 inches or something like that. And that's it. So the big fish, you can't kill a big fish, and that's why we have big fish. As far as licenses, everybody who fishes anywhere in Alberta needs what's called a wildlife identification number. That you get a little card that costs $8, lasts 5 years. And I'll just give you the rundown of the license costs here. A resident, which is defined as anyone who lives anywhere in Canada, not just in Alberta, but anywhere in Canada, gets a year-long license for $22.50. A non-resident, which is someone who lives outside of Canada, can get a season license for $61.50, a one-day license for $23.50, or a five-day license for $41.50. And Canadian residents over 65 don't need a license at all, and anyone under 16 doesn't need a license at all.
Mm-hmm.
Was there something else? I can't remember if that was.
Actually, that's can you fish it year-round?
Oh, I forgot that. Yes, you can. There are certain sections where fish spawn, short sections that are closed. But actually, that they would all be either above or below this Highway 22X to Carsland section. Now, part of the river will freeze over in the winter. Downstream, somewhere in the range of 5 to 10 miles downstream of Calgary, depending on how cold the winter is, the river will be frozen solid for, you know, a good portion of the winter. But the river in the city and down that far remains open all the time.
Okay. Let me just ask one question before we take another break, Jim. And that, we've had Greg Munther in Missoula, Montana, and Bill Dieter in Littleton, Colorado, ask about the impact of the sewage treatment plant in that section below 22X in Carsland.
Right. Let me just maybe start by sort of saying the role that this has played. There really are three things that have created this fishery in the Calgary region. One, I already mentioned, that's the restabilizing effect of the Bear's Paw Dam. It was built to restabilize the erratic flows caused by power dams upstream. The second is the natural characteristics of the river in this part of Alberta. This is where the river has the most suitable temperature range, and the fish have adequate spawning water, and the habitat within the river, the structure of the river itself, is good. And the third factor that has contributed to the this fishery is the introduction of nutrients from the city, these phosphates and nitrates that stimulate plant growth. And over the years, as the city has grown, there have been times when water quality became a concern because of sort of over-enrichment of the river by the city. And in each case, this was addressed by upgrades or additional water sewage treatment plants in the city. Not for the sake of the trout, but just for the sake of the water quality and the downstream users on the river. So certainly this is a factor in the fishery. And, when you send over these questions today, it's interesting. One of them sounds like he's concerned that the new upgrades and a new sewage plant that is going on stream is going to make the fishing decline. And then another question is that someone was concerned that the river was too polluted. So it's kind of an interesting scenario here. But certainly the nutrients stimulate plant growth, which, of course, provides habitat for aquatic insects, which are what the fish eat. And the river is in, I think, better hands and in better shape now as far as prospects for continued existence than it's ever been. When I first started fishing the river in the early 70s, the creation of the river was a complete accident, and it was maintained through nothing more than good fortune. And as we go along now, there's so many more people concerned with the river as a trout stream that I think its future's in better shape than it ever was. We have a really large and really active Trout Unlimited chapter here, that's one of the reasons that I feel better about the prospects for the continued health of the river. I mean, this is not a wilderness stream here. It's an unusual fishery, and it was a kind of a happy accident, if you like, that created the river. And sure. And now that it is this way, people are working much harder at trying to keep it healthy and keep the fish population sound.
That's very good news. Yeah. Let's take a brief break, and when we return, Jim will be answering more of your questions about Alberta's Bow River.
The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's wyotrout.com. Or call the Platte River Fly Shop at 307-237-5997. Again, that's 307-237-5997.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jim McLennan about fly fishing Alberta's famous Bow River. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com. Click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Jim your most important question. We're trying to answer as many questions as possible tonight. Jim, we have a question from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Jackie wants to know if there's someplace up there to fish for big bull trout, and if you have any suggestions regarding guides, perhaps.
Yeah, as far as bull trout, there are not any to speak of. Occasionally there's one down in the Bow around Calgary, but it's a real surprise. Some of our other streams have quite good bull trout fishing. Interestingly, Alberta made the bull trout its provincial fish and restricted all harvest of bull trout about, I don't have it in front of me, but 10 or 15 years ago, because they were declining in numbers, and they are a native fish, and we wanted to have them back. So our bull trout are recovering pretty nicely, and it's not hard to catch a bull trout in Alberta now in rivers. Some of the Bow tributaries, the Sheep River flows through the town I live in, the Highwood, main tributary of the Bow, both have bull trout, and all the streams in the Old Man River drainage, which is the next drainage south coming out of the mountains in Alberta, have bull trout. The Castle River, the Old Man itself, and the Lower Crow's Nest River. And also we have really good bull trout fishing in the northwestern part of Alberta. This is in the Peace River drainage. It's a long ways from here, but there's some pretty pristine bull trout fishing up there. And, of course, we've got bull trout fishing not far away in southeastern British Columbia also.
Jim, let me just interrupt briefly. We got an email in from Madison, Wisconsin, asking if you could speak up just a little bit.
Oh, certainly.
Go ahead, Roger.
You mean speak like this? Oh,
yeah.
Well, you mean speak louder.
Speak louder.
Sorry.
What are there any other fish there in the bow, like walleye, northern pike, or is the water too cold there for that?
Yeah, there are walleye and pike and perch and probably sauger and other warm water fish farther downstream. In this section that we fish for trout, there's a few pike. Every once in a while somebody catches a pike. I don't think I've heard of a walleye caught in the river up here. So the bow transitions from a trout stream into a warm water stream, but it happens quite a ways downstream of here.
And any problems with whirling disease, New Zealand mud snail, didymo, that kind of thing in the bow?
To this point, there doesn't seem to be. We had some investigation into whirling disease when it first sort of erupted in Montana, and I don't know that the investigation is continuing because it was the conclusion, or at least the assessment was that we didn't have it. And I've heard nothing contrary to that since, although, as I say, I'm not sure the investigation is still going on. The New Zealand mud snail, I have not heard of it being here. So far, so good on that front. I mean,
well, good for you. Good
yeah,
for you.
It's, I don't, it's not, nothing that we're doing that's, you know, it's not like we've got some secret preventative medicine, but so far, so good.
Well, maybe those strip searches at the border are
maybe that'll do
country,
it.
You know?
Yeah, that'll probably do it.
Jim, tell us a little about the equipment that you recommend for up there. We've had several questions submitted about that.
Right. I would say if you're going to wade and fish the bow, probably an 8.5 or 9-foot 5-weight rod with a floating line and a sink tip would allow you to do everything you want to do. If you're in a boat, sometimes it's nice to have a couple of rods rigged. And streamer fishing is a productive way to fish the river on foot or from a boat, particularly from a drift boat. You know, people like to pound the banks and with streamers, and that's probably a 9-foot 6-weight or maybe a 7-weight will do that well with a sink tip line, and then something else to fish dry flies or nymphs. You know, a 5-weight, probably a 9-foot 5-weight. Those two rods would do everything you'd need to for this sort of stuff. As far as leaders and things, pretty conventional stuff, except you don't want to go too light. The mistake that the visiting fishermen make, if they frequently fish in places where the fish aren't as big, they'll try and fish these fish on 6X tippet and stuff like that, and that's pretty much hopeless. So,
okay.
Fish streamers with 0X, 1X, 10 or 12 pound test, whatever, it doesn't matter. We get some nice caddis dry fly fishing in the evenings. 4 or 5X, that's about as fine as you want to go.
Can you talk about the hatches that you have on the river there?
Yeah, okay, that's a good plan. We get some pre-runoff hatches, which are kind of getting going now. We have some midges. We have a spring betis or blue-winged olive hatch, which happens in April and May. And they, to be quite frank, the dry fly fishing to those bugs pre-runoff is sort of spotty and puzzling. The fish sometimes don't bother with them much, even though the spring betis hatch can be really, really heavy. The spring bug that seems to get the fish going is we have it's our equivalent of the Mother's Day caddis, I guess. We don't get it in the numbers they do in some of the rivers around, maybe around Missoula, but we get a good, caddis hatch starting about mid-May, and it probably goes into mid-June, but what always does happen is we get our runoff arriving in this Calgary area right around the end of May. So typically we get some good caddis dry fly fishing. In fact, fishing is getting better and better, and then it's interrupted suddenly when runoff shows up. Then after runoff, we have pale morning duns show up in sort of mid to late June, along with the caddis, the evening caddis hatches that really go right through the summer. We have golden stoneflies that hatch late June for actually the kind of an ongoing hatch. I think there's several species they go through for a month or so probably. And then in the fall, we have, well, we get good hopper fishing starting in late July, depending on what the hopper crop is like. And then we have, our trichos are kind of spotty. We have them, some mornings you get spinner falls that'll get you some fish, sometimes you don't. And then the best fall dry fly fishing is with the fall blueing all over betas. And it's kind of a different story. The fish are much more interested in feeding on the surface with the fall hatch than they are with the spring. And we may have left something out, but that's about it.
Well, we did get a question from Roberto in Montreal. He wants to know if there's a green drake hatch there. You didn't mention that. So.
There is a nice green drake hatch on the upper bow in the area around Banff and Canmore. But not down here.
Okay.
I'm not really sure why, but that's, I think it's pretty much true. I've certainly never seen green drakes on the bow.
And then talking about flies, one of the questions we had here is the listener said that he's heard of a bow bugger.
Bow river bugger? Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bow river bugger, okay.
Yep, it's a pattern that was created by one of the guys I used to guide with back in the 80s, Peter Chenier. It is essentially a cross between a muddler and a woodbugger. It's got a marabou tail and a chenille body, a palmered hackle, and then a deer hair head at the front. And people are doing all sorts of variations on it with cone heads and rubber legs and flashaboo and all the other things that we put in flies these days.
Does it work?
It works great, yep. It's, it works lots of places, too. It's strangely enough, it doesn't only work on the bow. So.
What's it imitate?
Who knows? What's a regular woolly bugger imitate? I don't know.
It's kind of like in Alaska, they have the egghead leech, which is
egg-sucking leech, yeah.
Yeah, egg-sucking leech.
Yeah,
that has
fly with the attractive name.
Everybody wants to know, where are the egg-sucking leeches around?
Yeah, that's right. And the other one I like is the flesh fly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The flesh fly, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and not to forget the pellet nymph.
Oh, right. For fishing hatcheries.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Bob Heptenstall in Airdrie, Alberta, believes that he's had to go progressively down in size on his bead heads to 18s through 22s, and maybe not so much but for the worms, but is that your impression as well?
Yeah, I think that's correct, and it's good to hear from Bob. I know Bob. Yeah, the worm he's talking about is the San Juan worm, which is a real staple pattern on the river ever since whenever it was someone brought one up from your part of the world. It catches lots of fish here. But that seems to me to be a trend as fish get pressured a little. Of course, the dry fly fishing, they're going to eat whatever bugs, whatever size, are on the surface, and you imitate them with that size. But nymph-wise, it seems like they start to focus on smaller things, and I think it is happening on the bow, and I know it's happened on our other, probably best-known stream is the Crow's Nest River, where, used to fish size 10 and 12 nymphs all the time. Now it's 16 and 18, and I think he's correct, and I think that seems to be just a sequence of events as fish start to see more fishermen.
Okay. Well, Abe in Calgary wants to know, you get to pick three flies. What three flies are you taking?
Well, if I had to pick, if I could only fish with three flies, I'm not sure I'd fish, but if I did.
Sure you would.
Okay, I would. In fact, someone said that if you could only fish with three flies, I bet you'd catch just as many fish as you do with the thousands that we carry around, and that's probably true, too. Certainly for the bow, I would want some sort of caddis imitation, and I guess there's a little caddis that a friend of mine named Glenn Smith created a number of years ago. It's just a simple little CDC caddis that I'm sure would be my first choice in a caddis. And then it's a little hard. I guess I probably would want to have a Bow River bugger in about a size 6 or something like that. And then, if I only had three, I guess the other one should probably be a nymph. And I would say it would probably be like a little flashback pheasant tail or something in about size, maybe size 18.
Okay. And Roger down in, different Roger in Cheyenne wants to know,
Are there, in addition to those three, are there any flies that you just don't go onto the water without?
Yeah, I think the ones that I would, you know, that would fall into that category would be ones that I wouldn't want to go anywhere without, and that would be nymph flies. It would be a pheasant tail, and the copper john is a pretty universal bug these days. Dry fly-wise, that little caddis, parachute atoms, I really like the little parachute atoms. I'm getting old, and I need that white wing, and I can see it.
Careful.
Yeah. And you certainly want some hoppers. You know, stimulator's been a great fly for a long time. There's some discussion around here about people are seeming to feel that stimulators aren't working as well as they used to, and maybe the fish are getting used to seeing them, but that may be true. But some sort of a hopper, stonefly, dry fly would be essential. And, you know, the other one that I didn't mention earlier would be a clouser minnow. We fish clousers here a lot. That's such a great fly. Fly that sinks quickly but is still easy to cast. That would be a great choice. And, you know, I'm kind of old-fashioned. I still fish with things like an Adams and a hare's ear.
Good. Well, let's talk a little bit more about strategy and presentation on the river here.
Sure.
You said it was a big river. One of the questions was, what kind of casting skill does the Bow River require to be successful?
Well, it's interesting, and it is a big river. And human nature sort of says, oh, I guess what you do is you wade out to the middle and then cast as far as you can. And that's not the way to approach the Bow or probably any big river. It doesn't require any more casting skill than any other stream does, and that is to say that the better the casting, if you can put the fly on the spot and make it behave the way you want it to, you're going to catch more fish. And that's true everywhere. There's nothing, you know, it's not like you have to cast. I think maybe the question really is, do I have to be able to cast 70 or 80 feet to fish the Bow? And the answer is no, nothing like that. The dry fly fishing, if you're fishing to rising fish on the Bow, they're all, almost all the fish are in the shallows along the bank, and you're going to be within 30 feet of all of them, and be a lot closer than that sometimes too. And the, you know, most nymph fishing methods are suited to casts of 10 to 30 feet probably, and you can throw a little longer line with a streamer if you're trying to do a downstream swing with a streamer. But no, it doesn't require anything unusual. But I don't want that to sound like, you know, if you can't cast at all, you'll catch hundreds of fish. Cause
right,
that's not
right.
True anywhere, I don't think. So,
I think that's for the newcomers on the line, that's something that a newcomer should spend a lot of time with is casting and practice, because that can make all the difference in the world in your fishing. And the amount of fish you catch, and, you know.
It's absolutely true, and I might even jump in there with another kind of an observation. There's been a huge, I guess, increase or surge in nymph fishing over the last 10 years, I suppose. And I see this kind of good and bad. The good news is it allows people to catch a beginner or a new fly fisher to catch more fish than some of the other methods. And the reason is that you can learn to catch fish with using some of the nymph and indicator methods. You can learn to catch some fish without really learning to cast, which is good for a while. But on the other hand, it just seems to me a lot of people stall there, and because they're already catching fish, they don't worry about learning to cast. And you know, in the old days, you learned to cast first. You probably fished dry flies, and then later on, you'd try nymphing. And now it's the other way around. And I
Isn't it true a lot of these people that are new to fly fishing will get on a guide boat, float down a river like the Bow, and all you have to do is flip it out there about 20 feet?
That's true.
And mend your line, and you can catch a lot of fish.
Yep, and I always say that, you know, there are guides who are very good at this, and they can control the drift of the nymph and the indicator with their oars, you know, what they're doing with the boat. And I don't mean to say that I'm down on this, because I'm not. I just think one of the casualties of this is that people stall their progress sometimes at that point. And in the schools that we teach, I do quite a number of what I call intermediate level schools right on the Bow, specifically dealing with how to fish this river, because it's a little bit of a tough nut to crack for a for a new fly fisher. And the, so I'm with people who have fished for, you know, a few years, and the, you know, in the 20 years ago, the thing people would not know how to do would be how to fish nymphs. They would have fished dry flies. Now it's the other way around. Now they're intimidated more by, you know, making an accurate 30-foot cast to a rising fish with a, you know, a 12-foot leader and a 4-weight rod and a size 18 fly. That's what intimidates them, not this nymphing thing. They know how to do that. And it just seems like there's been kind of a shift.
Yeah.
Well, not 100% true, of course, but it does seem to be a trend.
I know what you're saying, yeah. It's time to take another break, and when we return, we'll talk to Jim more about strategies and presentation on the bow and try to dig a few secrets out of him.
Oh.
Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known lady guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring, where beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or email them at pudge@womensflyfishing.net. The phone number is 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113.
You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jim McLennan about fly fishing Alberta's famous Bow River. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and click on the link below the description of the show that says click here to ask Jim your most important question. We'll receive your questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Jim, one of the questions that came in as just a request is, please describe how a day on the Bow would go. A day in the life on the Bow, I guess, is what we're asking.
Well, I guess it would depend on what time of year it was you know, what sort of fishing you like to do, whether you're floating or walking. Let's just assume we're doing a float trip.
Okay.
Maybe that's not the right way to, but we'll do that. If it's the, you know, the summer season, sometime in July or August or something like that, you would have to probably make a decision as to whether you were going to fish the early part of the day or the late part of the day. The days are long, and you know, in July, it's light enough to fish by, it's hard to say because I'm not up this early that often, but you can certainly be, if you want to fish by 5:30, you can be fishing, and it's going to stay light enough to fish until 10, so it's hard to do the whole thing. If you wanted to, you know, what a lot of people would do is get kind of a late morning start with plans of staying until dark. So if you're floating, you'd probably either fish some streamers from the boat. Maybe if there's two guys fishing, it makes sense if one guy fishes a streamer and the other guy fishes what we call a hopper dropper setup, which is a buoyant dry fly that could imitate a hopper or a golden stone fly with a little beadhead nymph on a dropper about 3 feet beneath it. And that way, if you're going down the river, when you're fishing from the boat, you got one of everything going. You got a dry, an nymph, and a streamer happening, and you can see what works. If it was me, if I was one of the people, I would do that when we're drifting, and when we get to long, slow flats, I'd pull the boat in and get out, and maybe walk the bank looking for rising fish. And if I didn't see any, I'd probably fish the head of the pool with the hopper dropper rig, and then get back in the boat and do it again, and really come about 8:30 or so in the evening, just really get serious about what we call a snout hunt, looking for the big fish feeding in the shallow water as it gets closer to dark. Just trying, if we can stop in a good spot, everybody can go and, you know, walk and look for fish, look for rising fish. And then when that's over and it's good and dark, you float out and stumble around trying to pack up your stuff and go home. And I can't think of a nicer way to spend a day.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and I do think, just in brief summary, that we should have reassured Dave in Santa Barbara that the Bow is not an impossible river for the neophyte to fly fish, particularly if he's in the company of a guide.
Oh, definitely. Yes, I do for sure. It is a river. We have a lot of trout streams in Alberta, and you know, a guide is going to be an asset really on any of them for someone who has not been here or who is new to fishing. But the Bow is the one where a person most needs a guide, probably, just because it is big and the real thing a person needs to be consistently successful is versatility. They need to be able to switch methods and mm-hmm. do quite a variety of things. And a good guide, will work with the beginner. And if someone is considering hiring a guide, they should tell them what they're looking for, because it really runs quite a range what people are after when they hire a guide. Some people aren't interested in they don't really care too much about learning the finer points of casting and all that. They just want to catch some fish. But other people are embarking on the longer path to becoming a fly fisher. And if the guide knows that, then he'll make sure that he incorporates that sort of stuff into the day. But no, a neophyte with a good guide is going to catch fish.
Sean from Calgary wants to know, what's the single most important factor to being consistently successful on the Bow?
I think I probably answered it. That would definitely be versatility. If what you're doing isn't working, find out what is. And there's so many different things that you can do on the Bow. I mean, everything from bombing the banks with a drift boat with a size 2 streamer to sight fishing little size 18 nymphs to sighted fish in shallow water and rising fish and the hopper fishing and all the different kinds of nymph fishing, from nymphing in shallow sort of shallow riffles to nymphing the big deep heavy runs. And there's a fairly small number of people who are now starting to fish the Bow a little bit with trout spey rods, just because they can get the great, they can control the fly swing way out in the middle of the river and that sort of stuff. So the versatility undoubtedly is what a person needs to do. And I try and put it this way: you need to let the fish decide what's going to work. Sometimes people come to fish the Bow and all they want to do is fish dry flies, and fishing dry flies on the Bow is my favorite way of fishing the Bow, but it doesn't work great every time. So, if someone is going to be inflexible, they're putting all their eggs in one basket, and it may or may not turn out good. The guy who says, "Well, I'm prepared to do a little of everything, and whatever's working, I'm happy to do," that's the guy who's going to probably catch the most fish and probably going to have the most fun. So, versatility would be the answer, I think.
Okay.
Great, Jim. We have Jason in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and he says, it sounds like you do a lot of teaching, which, of course, you talked about. You have mm-hmm. your schools and your lessons and your trips that you do. What's the single biggest mistake, he wants to know, that you see beginners make when it comes to reading water?
The biggest mistake beginners make, I guess maybe I'll answer it with two things. On big water, such as we have here, I think the biggest mistake is not being, I guess, critical enough about where to fish. But part of what you do when you read a big water is decide where you're not going to fish. And you certainly don't want to take the approach that it's, I'm going to fish everything, and sooner or later I'll run across a fish. Well, that is true, I guess, but you want to really focus on the places where there are other fish. So deciding where not to fish. I guess in a general way for any fly fishing, I think people, beginners, bypass or underestimate the productivity of faster water and broken water. I think I see people who, they sort of, I guess, instinctively know that a trout needs some sort of shelter from the heaviest current, but they think that he needs an area of shelter the size of a gymnasium or something, so they fish only the big pools. But in reality, a trout, he does need some shelter from the heavy current, but he only needs is a quiet spot bigger than he is. Fast water with things interrupting the flow can hold a lot of fish, and sometimes that people don't, I think, bypass that in favor of the big deep pool. So I don't know if that helps or not.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it does. I think one of the things we all see, and maybe many of us do too, to remind ourselves is, like you said earlier, you got a big river, you want to wade out to the middle and start fishing because that's where all the big fish are.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, You just maybe waded through all the big fish.
Yeah, exactly. I see that a lot. I always describe it as the way that you fish a big river is just to pick away at the edges. That's all you do. And you don't, you know, we wade in the bow, but you don't, most of the wading you're going to do, it's a big river, but most of the wading is in water knee-deep or less, ankle-deep, or you're not in the water at all. You know, it's amazing how little deep wading you have to do, even in a big river. So.
And when you're drifting, are you usually working the banks, or are you out in the middle of the river?
We do it both ways. Some of the best drift boat fishing is just as the river is receding from runoff, and this would be sometime in late June probably. The river will still be high. It'll still have some color. It won't be completely muddy, but it'll be kind of a foggy green color with maybe 18 inches or so of visibility. And that's a good time to fish the streamers from a drift boat. It's also time that I think the fish are kind of pushed to the edges of the river a little bit. There's probably more fish on the banks than the cover is better. There's enough water on more of the banks for the fish to hold there. And any of the banks that are deep enough and have cover and, you know, and have good sort of feeding structure will be a good place to fish from a boat all the time. But as the water recedes, some of the mid-river lies become more important. In places where there's a shallow riffle and it falling into a deeper area out in mid-river. There's quite a number of islands in the river, so places where the two currents converge downstream of an island is good. So a little of everything. But it is important on the river to look for water with what I call character. And there are, to be honest, there are sections of the bow that don't have a lot of character. And by character, I mean places where the speed, the depth, the direction of the water are changing, and where the type of bottom and the type of surface are changing a lot. If you've got variety, you've got water that probably holds more fish, and you've certainly got water that's easier to read. You come to a long, straight stretch where it's all flowing the same speed. There's nothing interrupting the flow. It's the same gravel bottom all the way along. I tend to kind of push through those areas if I'm in a boat and look for places where there's more structure and more character. But to answer the question, the banks, the fish the good banks from the boat, but don't just fish the banks from the boat. There's lots of other stuff going on out in the middle of the river, too.
Good tips. And we've got lots of good questions on strategies and presentation. Jeff in New York wants to know what's your favorite dry fly and what time of year do you go to it?
Favorite dry fly, it would probably be that little caddis, that little CDC caddis that I talked about earlier, and that that would be a prime fly. I would probably fish that every evening I could get out between late June and the middle of September. We get some caddis hatches pretty much every day. They vary in intensity, but that's probably our most reliable rising fish hatch. Is caddis and through the summer, starting late in the day.
Okay. And Phil in Minnesota wonders, what do you look for in terms of activity as you approach the water? If there are not rising fish, how do you decide what and where you do?
That's a really good question. And that, I think he summed up the problem that people have with the bow is they... So here we are at the river. What are we going to do? And it's fly fishing. The great thing about fly fishing is there's very little hard information that the river and the fish give us, but they do give us clues. And that's where the fun comes from, trying to interpret all these clues. So a little bit of knowledge about what has been going on would be good, of course. As far as choosing a fly, if you know of something important that's been happening. For instance, if this is early July, a person could check with the fly shops and they would probably say, well, the golden stoneflies are hatching, so you might want to fish with a stonefly nymph or an adult stonefly. And the interesting thing about the golden stones on the bow is that the hatch can actually be in full swing and you might never see an adult fly, and that's because almost all the hatching, emerging and egg-laying activity happens after dark. So you just watch for the empty shucks on the rocks, and when there's a lot of those around, you know that there's adults around someplace. So you can fish an adult stonefly kind of as a much like you would a hopper. You're just kind of prospecting and looking for fish. So I would try and have some of that knowledge about what has been going on. I would keep my eyes out for rising fish. If I'm not seeing rising fish, I would try and, you know, depending on the light and the water clarity, you know, keep your eye out looking into the water. That's a skill that North American fishermen are generally not as good at as they might be, is being able to see fish in the water. And look for this structure stuff that I'm talking about. You know, make sure you're fishing water with character. If you're not seeing the fish themselves, then look for the strongest hint you can get, and that'll come from the what the river's telling you. And, you know, in the middle of summer, if there's no fish rising and you're not seeing any bug activity, I would look for broken water, not necessarily deep water, but broken water with some defined current seams or defined slower slots, that sort of stuff. And I would probably fish fish that hopper dropper thing and try and see if there's some fish, you know, that have been looking at adult stoneflies or that would be willing to take a little nymph. So look for character in the water, and you know, and the most reliable way to catch fish in the river is undoubtedly with nymphs. You know, as they say, day in and day out, that's probably what catches the most fish. And you know, so that means that if you play the odds, that's probably what you would do.
Jim, we have a question from another neighbor of yours up in Calgary there. His name's Jim Thompson. He says, do you find you get a lot of tangles when you're fishing two flies with the San Juan as the bottom fly? Is there a way to avoid this problem?
No, I never get any tangles when I
Right.
Do I get yes? If you'd stopped it where he said, do you get tangles? I would just say yes. stopping right there. When the San Juan worm is the bottom fly?
Bottom fly.
It depends on how you rig them up, I guess. When I fish nymphs, my big thing is I want to be able to switch from one method to another without a lot of fooling around. And when I fish nymphs, generally, if I fish more than one, the way I do it is I tie the biggest fly or the heaviest fly onto the leader, on the end of the leader, and then I put tie another piece of tippet into the eye of that fly and make it sort of 12 or 18 inches long and tie the second fly on there. So I go eye to eye with two nymphs. And what I like about that is that if I want to switch to a streamer or a dry fly, I can get rid of that whole rig with just undoing one knot. And I don't have droppers and all sorts of it's a little less a complicated system. It tangles up. I think it may tangle a little less than using a true dropper setup where you've got the dropper actually coming perpendicularly off the you know, the tippet somewhere. There's no way around some of those tangles, I don't think. I know some of the guys here use, when they're nymphing, they use, I think it's Maxima tippet material because it's so stiff and is a little less prone to tangles. At least that's the theory. The other thing, of course, is your casting can really influence how much you get tangled up with anything, but especially with multi-fly rigs. And if you're casting those things, you want to make sure you throw an open loop so you really don't want to cast tailing loops if you've got, you know, two flies, three split shot, and a strike indicator on there. You're going to have more trouble. So make sure that you learn how to cast with an open loop, which, of course, breaks all the rules of conventional fly casting when you're not using weight. So you've got, that's the unfortunate thing about all this is if someone learns to cast, you know, with a little dry fly on and learns to have nice tight loops and a little flick of the rod tip, if you cast that way with a big weighted nymph rig, it's going to be a mess. So you've got to break the rules, cast an open loop, and, you know, if you use a fair amount of force casting in order to keep the flies above your head on your forward cast and hope for the best. But you're going to still get tangled up part of the time, once in a while.
We all get tangles.
We do.
We all get tangles.
We do.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time, and we need to wrap things up here,
Jim.
Oh,
okay. That went fast.
Yeah, it goes fast, doesn't it?
It does, it does.
It's fun to talk about fishing.
That's right.
When we return, we're going to give away two of your books, Blue Ribbon Bow, published by Johnson Gorman Publishers, and your Fly Fishing Western Trout Streams, published by Stackpole. So those will be great gifts to give away, and also a subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So stay tuned to see if you win.
Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong. There is a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature, and a support network which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's Reeling, R-E-A-L-I-N-G, and Healing, H-E-A-L-I-N-G, Midwest.org. Or www.ifishon.org, ifishon.org. Or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Well, from our global events calendar tonight, we have some good news from Virginia. The 7th Annual Virginia Fly Fishing Festival will be held April 21st and 22nd on the banks of the South River in Waynesboro, Virginia. Proceeds from that event will help restoration of the South River, and the $10 admission covers all lectures as well as a wine tasting for those 21 years and older. An all-star cast has been assembled for the event, and topics will cover much of the world of fly fishing. You can even sign up for a fly casting class with Bob Clouser. Go to the Global Events calendar. The link is near the bottom of each page on our website. Look under Virginia for more information. Fly shops and clubs, you can list all your fly fishing related events on our Global Events calendar. It's free. You do it yourself on the website. Go to the events calendar and get started. Get your events out there for everyone to see. Classes, demos, clinics, shows, schools, anything related to fly fishing. We'll be highlighting one event from the calendar on each of our shows.
Well, just a reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, "What did you think of this show?" Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away Jim's books and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. These winners of the drawings are randomly selected from our database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do for the next show. You don't want to miss out on a chance to win some of these incredible prizes we give away. Now, if you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how to receive your gift. So here it goes. Now, the first thing that we're going to draw for is Jim's Blue Ribbon Bow book. And I'm going to press our magic button here that makes the selection. And I have Tom Ursino in Alberta, Canada. Well, wow. You ought to be able to use your book.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, that's a good choice there. So
we had a lot of questions from Ursino. Alberta. And
Yeah. And then we have the second book to give away, and that book.
That's Fly Fishing the Western.
Yeah, Rivers. Fly Fishing Western Trout Streams, published by Stackpole. And press the magic button here, and we've got Kemper Eagle in Virginia. Kemper Eagle.
All right.
Well, Kemper should look at that events calendar and check out that event as well. Oh. And then lastly, we have the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and that is Tom Marks in New York. Tom Marks in New York. So congratulations, gentlemen. You've got some great gifts, and we're sure you're going to enjoy them.
Absolutely. And you know, some of these names are looking familiar now as we get older in our experience. There are folks from all around the country and even around the world who are following us on a regular basis. Well, Jim, gosh, I can't tell you how much we appreciate you being with us tonight. The thing I feel shorted is that we didn't get to hear about all the other places in Alberta that are great to fish, and I think that means we'll have to think about having you back another time if you've got time for us.
Well, I'd love to do it. As you said, it's always fun to talk about fly fishing, and I enjoyed it, and you guys are doing a great job, and I'd be happy to come back. And there's some stuff on some of the other fisheries in Alberta on our website and stuff, too.
Absolutely.
So we can check
great,
it out.
Great. And be sure to visit Jim's website. Jim, you want to give your website address one more time?
Yes, it's www.mclennanflyfishing.com, and you spell McLennan, McLennan.
Great, great. So be sure to check out Jim's site, and you'll learn more about what he, his wife,
very
and
nice
you do.
Site.
Yeah. Well, on our next broadcast, which will be on May 2nd at 7 p.m. Mountain Time and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be featuring Paul Mariner, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. So Paul Mariner will share his 25-plus years of experience with fly fishing for Atlantic salmon. So be sure to listen in and learn his secrets about tactics, flies, casting, and playing the classic trophy fish. We'd like to thank the R.L. Winston Rod Company, Mountain River Lanyards, Platte River Fly Shop, and Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site, like the events, calendars, and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.